Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Poore, and I have as my guest today Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter was a weapons inspector back during the Bush administration, and he's going to talk about his history as a weapons inspector. So, Scott, you've been involved in foreign policy for a while, right?
Well, I mean, I have been involved in national security issues for some time. I was commissioned in 1984 as an officer in the Marine Corps. I was trained as an intelligence officer, and I, spent some time working issues pertaining to the Middle East, potential American deployment of military forces back in the 1980s to respond to a potential Soviet threat or during the Iran-Iraq War. And then in 1988, I was assigned to the On-Site Inspection Agency as a weapons inspector. My job was to go into the Soviet Union and implement the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. That was a treaty signed between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in December 1987 did away with two categories of nuclear-armed ballistic missiles, short-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles that were considered to be extremely stabilizing to European and international security at the time. So that's how I cut my teeth on the weapons inspector business, by getting involved in the very first on-site inspection, arms control verification regime in modern history.
What was that like?
Well, that was fascinating. I mean, first of all, I have to say that, it's an accident of history that I got involved in that. I was a Russian history major in college and took 2 years of Russian, but under no circumstances did I speak fluent Russian. But for whatever reason, in 1988, when the Marine Corps was tasked with providing officers to this very elite organization, to give you an example, the other inspectors that were being brought in were generally speaking, colonels, lieutenant colonels, a few majors, very experienced people, all of whom not only spoke Russian, but had been formally trained as foreign area officers. That means that they were specialists in the Soviet Union. Many of them had served as defense attachés in Moscow. A lot of them had served in a very specialized program called the Military Liaison Mission out of Potsdam, a group of intelligence officers who were stationed in East Germany, whose job was to monitor the Soviet military in East Germany in order to, stay abreast of military exercises, equipment, etc. These were the best of the best, the elite. And I was an intelligence officer in 29 Palms, California, doing combat intelligence, the furthest thing from what these guys deal with. And yet the Marine Corps, in its infinite wisdom, saw that I had 2 years of Russian language and suddenly plucked me out of Southern California and put me in with these other very highly capable people. And I became an inspector. I was the least qualified inspector you could imagine, linguistically and from a practicality standpoint. I didn't know anything about ballistic missiles, but suddenly I found myself, 700 miles due east of Moscow in the foothills of the Ural Mountains at a Soviet intercontinental ballistic missile factory monitoring ballistic missile production. It was just a fascinating thing. I was an old Ronald Reagan Republican raised in a military family. We joked about, my mantra being kill a commie for mommy, better dead than red, things of this nature. And I truly believe that. And suddenly I'm in the Soviet Union, working with my Soviet counterparts, and it was an eye-opening experience. These were human beings. This wasn't the enemy. It was a fascinating experience.
So from what you're saying, you kind of enjoyed your time in still the Soviet Union, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, it was the Soviet Union when I traveled there for the first time in June of 1988. And just so you understand, I was the least qualified inspector when I joined the agency, and yet I was the first inspector on the ground in the Soviet Union. It was a big honor and a privilege to be handpicked to be among the first team that went to the Soviet Union. And you know, at that time, you know, the Iron Curtain was still there. This was a great mystery. When we arrived in this factory town, the town of Votkinsk, where this missile factory was, we were the first non-Soviets that had been in that city since World War II, when German prisoners of war helped build, buildings and bring the, modernize the town. And when those German prisoners of war left, this was an area denied to foreigners. And suddenly you have Americans, not just Americans, but American intelligence officers appearing in this city full of people who looked at us as if we were from Mars. And we looked at them the same way. This was the enemy. This was the Soviet threat. And suddenly, we're living in a city, living amongst the Soviets, working with our counterparts to do a very difficult but important job. And it was a humanizing process. It stripped away, the layers of ignorance-based fear of myth. And we got to see each other as just, fellow human beings working together to accomplish a common task. It was an important time. It was a fascinating time, and I enjoyed it very much.
At that time, or maybe even today, people in the United States view people in Russia and the Soviet Union as being kind of, different and, maybe less than human, I might say. How did the Russian people view Americans?
Well, they, like everybody, they had been subjected to propaganda, just like we Americans had been subjected to propaganda about the Russians, about the Soviet Union. They had been subjected to propaganda about the United States. They were surprisingly well informed about the history and geography of the United States. We weren't, a totally foreign concept. But they had, stereotypes that every American was a capitalist, that we were very racist, that the black people were being oppressed, and that that there was a working class being oppressed by the capitalists, that the officer class, of which I was part of, was somehow an elite superior class oppressing the poor working enlisted men, etc. And suddenly we show up there as this team of that's integrated, and we were a well functioning team where we where we got along with one another. We were humans. We were well read. We enjoyed culture. We enjoyed nature. We enjoyed the same things they enjoyed. We enjoyed good food, good conversation, and it was fascinating to watch the Russians come to this realization that the people they thought we were was just dead wrong. At the same time, we were coming to the realization that the people we thought they were was dead wrong. It was like the veil being removed on both sides, and suddenly you're staring face to face with fellow human beings. And as I said, it was just a unique time in history, a unique set of circumstances, and it is one that I will treasure forever. Now, we were doing a very important job. We weren't there as tourists. We weren't there to, our primary mission was not interacting with Soviet citizens at all. Our job was to inspect a missile factory to ensure that the missiles they were producing were not prohibited by the treaty that had just been signed. And, this was a very contentious piece of work, because the Soviets were producing very high tech, very capable intercontinental ballistic missiles that were very secret. They didn't want us to see them, but because of the treaty, we had to inspect those missiles to make sure that they weren't part of the prohibited missiles. And so, you know, we had this very contentious work that we were doing at the factory, and then you fold into that the fact that we were living amongst these factory workers, we were living amongst these Soviet citizens. So, you know, we'd finish a difficult day at work, and then we'd be, you know, walking the streets of the city, talking to our Soviet counterparts. It was just a fascinating time.
Well, it sounds like by day you were one person, and in the evening you were totally somebody else. That had to be kind of difficult to be like a weapon inspector in the morning and then comrades in the afternoon. Was that difficult?
Well, we weren't allowed to be comrades. The thing about it is that's what made it even more difficult is that, you know, we had a security and a counterintelligence aspect to our work where we had to be on the guard for the Soviets seeking to take advantage of these kinds of relationships, because we were, after all, intelligence officers. You know, we possessed, security classifications. We possess national secrets, and the KGB definitely would like to get a hold of that. So we had to be on the guard for the Soviets taking advantage of this camaraderie and seeking to exploit that and get it for the same way they had to be on the guard for us doing the same against them. So it's not as though we let our guard down after work and suddenly we're out there dancing and drinking and having a good time. It was a very guarded relationship, especially early on when we were filling each side out to see what the objectives were. It turned out that the Soviets weren't trying to spy on us and we weren't trying to spy on them. We were both committed to doing the job. But because of decades of mistrust, when you first interacted, you had to be suspicious of what their motives were.
You used the word distrust. Would you say that was a deliberate action by our government to create that perception?
Well, I mean, nothing occurs in a vacuum, and we were living in the time of the Cold War, and we were two nations that were opposed to each other. Even though we weren't in a hot war, we were opposed to each other. And our nations had a history of spying on one another. We have arrested numerous Soviet spies. They have arrested numerous American spies. And so It wasn't as if, as if we were making this up. There was a history of the KGB seeking to recruit Americans. Indeed, just a few years before I went to the Soviet Union, they had penetrated the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and turned a Clayton Lowentry, a Marine guard. They had, it caught him up in a what they call a honey trap, where they used a Russian girl, and next thing you know, he's allowing KGB officers access to the most sensitive parts of the U.S. Embassy. So it wasn't that this was pure propaganda. There was an element of reality there. We were opponents. We were enemies. We were preparing to fight a war. When I was in the Marine Corps, I trained to kill Russians. I mean, this was my job. So it wasn't purely propaganda. This was reality. We were two countries that were geared to go to war against each other. And suddenly this totally artificial new reality appears, where you have, American inspectors going to the most sensitive facilities in the Soviet Union, living amongst the Soviet people. And there were Soviet inspectors in the United States, in Utah, the American Missile Factory in Utah, doing the same thing, living amongst the American people, doing their job at the American at the missile factory. And that's what made this process so unique, because it began a process of normalization. It began a process of, of tearing down the propaganda, of building bridges of trust between the Soviet Union and the United States. It was a critical process, not from just a national security standpoint. We were getting rid of missiles that were very dangerous. We were for the first time eliminating nuclear armed missiles. We were reducing missiles as opposed to just controlling how many we could have. But we were also involved in a process that ultimately led to the end of the Cold War, to the normalization of relations between the Soviet Union and then later Russia and the United States.
Is my understanding correct that the Russians could not continue to fund arms as much as they used to, and that's what bankrupted the country? Is that correct?
It's roughly correct. The Russians had an economic model that was heavily dependent upon central control, and they were able to fund these missiles by doing a number of things. For example, the town we lived in Votkinsk was a factory town, and what I mean by that is the Votkinsk machine building plant, which is the factory that builds these missiles, was the number one employer. It was like an old American steel mill town where, you know, you have a city that only produces steel, and so the number one power in the town is the steel factory. The most important person is the manager of the factory, and that's the same thing that was in Votkinsk. And these military factory towns appeared all over the Soviet Union, and they were given priority to produce this high-quality military equipment with little regard to what the actual cost was. And at some point in time, when Gorbachev came in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the head of the Soviet Union, he made a determination that there was a stagnation that had taken a hold of the Soviet Union, an economic stagnation. And to break free of that, he had to end this kind of centralized control. This was the perestroika, restructuring, and the glasnost, openness that came along with it. And as he sought to dismantle this decades-old system, the Soviet economic model, indeed the political model attached to it, because once you start to change the nature of a factory town, you don't just change the economics, you change the politics, because now the factory manager isn't calling the shots anymore. Other people are calling the shots, and there's decades of resentment and such. And this is what occurred. It wasn't just that we got involved in an arms race and we were building weapons and they were building weapons and they couldn't keep up. That's a gross oversimplification of it. The fact of the matter is the Soviets were building a lot of weapons. They were building good weapons. But the new leadership had decided that they didn't want to continue this process, this model, that it was stagnant, and that in order to thrive as a nation, they needed to change. But that process of change was too much for the Soviet system to handle and eventually collapsed from within.
Wow. So Americans, is their perception of what went on back then, do you think they have the right perception or no?
No, I still think that the collapse of the Soviet Union was very fast. I mean, it took everybody, even the CIA, by surprise. And it's one of the reasons why this occurred is that we didn't understand what was really going on. We didn't understand the true nature of perestroika, of glasnost. And this, again, was fascinating because as weapons inspectors living in the Soviet Union, we actually got to see this firsthand. I mean, we were in a factory town. We were reading the newspapers. We were watching the local TV. We were talking to the people, and we were experiencing the changes. And yet when I came out, and me and the other inspectors came out and tried to explain this to the elite analysts in Washington, D.C., they just put up their nose and went, you're just little provincial people in the middle of nowhere. We're busy looking at Moscow and St. Petersburg, looking at the big picture. And we're saying, no, guys, this is the big picture. What we're trying to tell you here, food shortages, material shortages, confusion as to how you restructure the economy, leading to massive, discontent amongst the people. This is what's going on, not just in Vodkinsk, but throughout the entire Soviet Union. The analysts didn't get it, and the Soviet Union collapsed quickly. And one of the big mistakes we made as a nation is because at the time we were engaged in the Cold War. You know, it was a contest. We were, it was us versus them. We didn't to credit the collapse of the Soviet Union to the reality that existed in the Soviet Union. We had to declare victory. We said we won. We won because we outproduced them. We bankrupted them. They couldn't keep up. That is a simplistic, ignorant, and incorrect point of view. We didn't win. They lost, not because we were better, but because they couldn't. Their system was incapable of being sustained. And that's the big mistake that is carried over, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, we behaved as if, Russia was somehow a defeated enemy that we could come in and we could occupy peacefully and we could remold into into a vision that we saw, with total disregard to what the Russians wanted, what the Russians needed, what the Russian reality was. And so in the decade of the 1990s was a disaster in terms of U.S.-Russian relations, where we were propping up this alcoholic named Boris Yeltsin, where we actually, there's a lot of talk today about the Russians interfering in American elections. In 1996, we bought the Russian election for Boris Yeltsin. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. We stole the election. He was going to lose. We went in there, manipulated the system, poured in millions of dollars, and bought the election. And the Russians realized that. The man who was sitting at Boris Yeltsin's side from 1998 on was Vladimir Putin. And he watched the Americans come in. He watched how we treated Yeltsin. He watched how we treated Russia. And when he became the president, he said, never again. That's the root of what's going on here. But again, we don't recognize this root. We only see him as a man who is opposed to what we're trying to do, as if what we're trying to do is the great right and everything Putin wants to do in Russia is the great wrong. But that's not the case. What Putin's trying to do in Russia is Russians working for the benefit of Russians. And, they view what America is doing as intervention, as interfering in their, in their internal affairs.
So this whole thing about the Russians getting involved in the American election of 16, 18, and 20, you don't buy that?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me put it this way. I'm an American citizen. I'm informed on the issues. I know what's important to me. And I read, I talk about this, and I know who I want to vote for and why I want to vote for them. And there's no Russian involvement in any of that process. And I respect my fellow citizens enough to believe that they operate on the same basic model. It's the most insulting thing in the world for someone to say that the Russians, by purchasing $50,000 or $100,000 of Facebook ads, swayed an election, convinced the American people to do something that they weren't going to do. Michael Bloomberg, when he was running for the Democratic nomination, spent $500 million on the most sophisticated advertisement program in the history of American politics, and he lost. and suddenly we're supposed to believe that the Russians, working from a basement in St. Petersburg, planting crude, stupid, ignorant Facebook ads, suddenly convinced the American people to vote in a way they weren't otherwise going to. No, I don't buy this at all. This is an absurdity in the extreme. And it's an insult to Americans to suggest that we're that vulnerable. You know, our democracy is a strong institution. You know, we have weathered various storms over the course of our history. We have had outside people trying to influence, but the Americans vote the way we want to vote because of what we believe in. I may not agree with, you know, the vote you cast, but it's the vote you get to cast because you believe in what you believe. I do the same thing. But there's not a foreign power whispering in our ears telling us how to vote. It's us voting the way we want to vote because of what we believe in. And to suggest otherwise is an insult to American democracy.
Wow, you've been saying some incredible, wonderful things, Scott. And our time is almost up for today. And I would love to have you back on the show for a ongoing dialogue about foreign affairs and the history of what you've done and what you see in the future. So if you're okay, would you like to share some contact information if somebody wants to get involved, you know, interested in hearing more about what you say? Would you share, like, your Facebook page?
Absolutely. I don't know what my, to be honest, I don't know what my, I think it's just Scott Ritter at Facebook. I also am on Twitter, the real Scott Ritter on Twitter. I publish articles. I do some commentary, and I'd be more than happy to join with you in the future to discuss this and other issues pertaining to, you know, international relations, foreign policy, et cetera.
Terrific. One quick question before we end the show. You've done a lot of writing, kind of outlined the kind of writing that you've done over the past couple of years.
Well, I mean, ever since I stopped in government service, I got involved in the anti-war movement, and so I did a lot of writing trying to educate the American public about the reality of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs and American policy objectives in the Middle East vis-a-vis Iraq. And I've expanded that to get into, you know, nuclear disarmament, et cetera. I've written a number of books. In fact, I just had a book come out just a couple months ago called Scorpion King. It's a history of America's nuclear weapons program and our failed arms control policies from Franklin Delano Roosevelt all the way up to Donald Trump. So I write about that. I write about you know, broader national security interests. Today, I even delve into you know, domestic American politics insofar as you know, national security interest and geopolitics have an impact on that. So I write on a broad range of subjects, primarily on military, national security, foreign policy.
Scott, it's been such a wonderful conversation. I look forward to, you know, having more. You've been listening to Scott Ritter. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits the Show. Follow us on Twitter. Thank you. Have a great day. Thanks, Scott. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.